But this email I received from my brother-in-law, Rabbi Dr. Avi Oppenheimer, who is a neuroradiologist in the Cleveland Clinic in South Florida. So he sends an email that says the following. I currently work in the Cleveland Clinic in Florida, and I was in Dr. Tsakis, parenthetical, his name is Andreas Tsakis, it's a Greek name, our transplant surgeon's office yesterday reviewing an MRI. I noticed the curious portrait behind his desk of the baby born through a C-section. Now, I do have, if anybody's interested, this photograph, which is really, really gross. I couldn't even look at it. But for those who are interested in this kind of thing, if you want, I'll be happy to get it for you. But the commitment was this is going to be very clean. Each of the surgeons having subsequently signed their name on the picture. When I asked our transplant surgeon what he would be doing with the gynecology picture, he explained that this is the picture, remember I received this on Friday, this is the picture of the very first baby born a few weeks ago, it was in September of this year, born to a woman with a transplanted uterus. Dr. Tsakis was a consultant on this case. So we'll come back to this very, very briefly at the end, but there was some halachic discussion about this topic about 80 and 100 years ago, and at that time it was actually what we could call Hilchos Olam Mashicha. It wasn't true. There was reports of such a case, but there had never been a successful uterine transplant performed, not in England, by Dr. Morris. Nobody had ever, until just recently. So in Sweden, 2 years ago, this, you can look online, this Dr. Tsakis was part of a team that transplanted 7 or 9 women with transplanted uteruses, and then more recently, he said that last week, a different baby was born from another patient with a transplanted uterus. In that case, the donor of the uterus was the mother of the recipient. Was the grandmother of the baby that was born. Meaning that the same uterus gave birth to the daughter and the grandson. How's that for a question of Pidyon Bechor? That was the end of the email from my brother-in-law. But what we're seeing is that there is just this absolutely astonishing development in the world of medicine. And at the same time, there is really an eye-opening world of halacha that deals with these modern medical advances in light of traditional Torah sources that have sustained us spiritually throughout the generation. So we're going to look this morning kind of had a survey of something that could take us many months to study, and that is the topic of Jewish law, the interplay, the interface of Jewish law and fertility medicine, just as an overview. And it's important to keep in mind that this is, for many people, it's a very sensitive topic personally, because according to the research that I found, that's what you'll find with Machon Puah and others, so approximately 1 in 6 couples at some point in their life is faced with an infertility challenge. And this is obviously an extremely difficult one. It's one that's, so to speak, in Yonah Diyoma in the Parsha, because the Imahos, our foremothers, were Akaros. Maybe part of the discussion in Achronim is if there would have been such a thing as a uterine transplant, maybe Sarah wouldn't have been an Akara. But the idea that a couple is facing a challenge, having a child, which is so much a part of what a Jewish home is about, is a very, very difficult and sensitive one and needs to be respected and understood with that great deal of sensitivity. So what we're going to discuss here is only in the realm of the theoretical. It's only to appreciate what the halacha has to say, but we should be very careful when discussing these topics in an individual setting to understand the sensitivity with which people who are challenged with this difficulty face. So to do this, we could think about different scenarios, and we don't have time for too many, but maybe thinking about, let's say, 3 different scenarios that we can come back to over the course of the morning, the next few minutes, and then reflect on them at the end. You have a couple, Lo Aleinu, they've been married for 5 years and they have no children. So they come to the rabbi, and they've been trying to have children for several years, and they want to know, are they obligated, from a Torah standpoint, to pursue assisted reproductive technologies? Is that something that is a chiyuv, an obligation on them? Or can they say, look, we're going to go with the flow and whatever happens, happens. That's scenario number one. Are they obligated? Scenario number two, you have a couple, Baruch Hashem, they are blessed with 9 children. We have 4 children, that's a wonderful blessing. 9 children. 9 children, gewalt. Happens to be they're all boys. So we have three boys, that's very Leibedik. Imagine you have nine boys, that could be very Leibedik. And they come to the rabbi, they say, look, we heard that the mitzvah of Puruvu, which we'll talk about in a minute, requires that a couple have one boy, at least, and one girl. And we have nine boys. So what's the plan of action here? Should we seek some kind of medical intervention that could potentially ensure that we have a girl? That's scenario number two. And then you have scenario number three, which gets a little bit more complex, where you have a couple and the husband, for whatever reason, has no sperm. So we'll talk about this a little bit more later. Somehow someone else is going to provide the sperm for this couple to have a child, but the father is a Kohen. So he starts cheshbonning to himself, what's going to happen if someone donates sperm for this couple, if the wife gives birth and it's a boy? So when it comes to the kid's bar mitzvah, they're going to call him up, Ploni ben Ploni. So now what do you do? Can this couple pursue an avenue where they can choose to only have daughters so that they would spare themselves of the potential embarrassment of having the son of a Kohen who may not be a Kohen? So these are three simple scenarios that we should explore together. And what I'd like to do is kind of break this presentation into two halves. The left side, which is what we'll do initially, is just the background of the basic mitzvah of Puruvu. And the left and the right side is going to be a survey of some of the medical topics. And you have packets to follow along. If you don't have a packet, just raise your hand. There should be more floating around. You don't have a packet? Maybe, here's an extra one. Okay. So we're going to begin. Oh, no, that's not the right one. All right. If you'll grab one, or somebody will grab one for you. We're going to begin with the basic mitzvah of Puruvu. There is a question in the Rishonim whether or not there is a mitzvah, whether it's a specific commandment for someone to get married. This is a big discussion in the Rishonim, whether marriage itself is a mitzvah. But certainly, Puruvu is a mitzvah. The Pasuk says it multiple times. It says in Bereishis, it's repeated in Parshas Noach. So the discussion becomes, what are the parameters of Puruvu? So the Mishnah tells us in Maseches Yevamos, Lo yevatel adam mipiriyah v'rivya elim kem yesh lo bonim. A person should not cease from piriyah v'rivya, and we'll see this language is important a little bit later on, unless they have children. Beis Shammai says two sons, Beis Hillel Omrim, and this is how we paskin, this is how we rule, Beis Hillel Omrim, Zachar unakeva, one male child and a female child, Shenemar, Zachar unakeva bra'am. Now, we could spend a lot more time discussing this aspect because there are many particulars of this law. One is that these children themselves have to be capable of bearing their own children. And two is that, lo aleinu, they shouldn't predecease their parents. That means when a person passes on, if they don't have any children, then they will have not fulfilled, according to the strict rules and regulations, they will not have fulfilled the mitzvah of Puruvu. But that's not the only mitzvah, because the Gemara mentions in several places there are two other components of that mitzvah, and one is called Sheves. The Pasuk says, Lo tso baral the Sheves Yitzara, that God didn't create the world to be empty, rather he meant it to be populated. So not only is there a strict mitzvah of Puruvu, which it says in the Chumash, the Navi brings this verse that says that we should populate the world, and similarly, La'erev al tanach yadecha, in the evening don't let your hands rest, just because you had children when you were younger. The Pasuk says the person, this is the discussion, in that Maseches Yevamos discussion, a person should continue to have children when they are older. So there's the primary mitzvah of Puruvu, then there's a more expanded view of the mitzvah called Sheves, and the Gemara assumes that this mitzvah is very important. So Tosfos here, which is the Tosfos that you're looking at is on Daf Mem Aleph Amud Beis, I believe in Maseches Gittin. Tosfos points out that this is a mitzvah, Puruvu is a more narrow mitzvah, lo hava kafinale. But hacha kafinale, we coerce the person, and not in addition, haikra mushum demucha the mitzvah rabbi. You notice from this pasuk that the reason the world was created, lo so bara, was la sheves yitzar, was to have children. Therefore, it's a mitzvah rabba. So that explains why the Gemara says in Maseches Megillah that generally we are not permitted to sell a Sefer Torah for any just general reason. But when it comes to having children, then it is permitted even to sell a Sefer Torah. Because it's considered, Tosfos said, it's considered a mitzvah rabba. It's a great mitzvah. So here already, we're kind of developing ourselves the fact that there is a biblical mitzvah, and this is actually, if you look in the Sefer HaChinuch, this is the first mitzvah which is given. And in addition, there are the additional levels of Sheves, of populating the world, La'er v'altana kadecha, continuing to have children, and the fact that Tosa says it's a mitzvah. And this is codified in the Rambam on page one of your packets in the Sefer HaMitzvos. For the Rambam, it's the 12th mitzvah, HaMitzvah Reshit Beis. He should sivanu lifros v'lirbos, to be multiple and have more children, ulechavin l'kayim amin, and to have kavana for the intent of continuing the population. So there is further discussion in the Achronim about this mitzvah. Is it just population in general, which is the connotation of the word sheves, population, or is it specifically Jewish children, and which is why in Europe, in certain communities, those who unfortunately weren't able to have children used to donate money to orphanages or to Talmud Torahs and yeshivas so that they could help raise children otherwise. They themselves didn't have children, but they were helping raise Jewish children by extension. So this is kind of the basic mitzvah, and there is a Kabbalistic component which appears in the Gemara. The Gemara says that the Mashiach will come when all of the neshamos shebeguf, there's a box, there's a heavenly box, whatever this means, called the guf, and when all the neshamos are essentially finished being utilized from this box, is like a treasure house upstairs with all the neshamas, and when they continue to dole them out one step at a time, we get closer to the Mashiach. So the more children that come into the world, the more, essentially, more neshamas that are taken out of this box, and by the time the box is empty, them in the Mashiach will come. That's what it says in the Talmud. It's not some obscure source, it's in the Gemara. What that means, I'm not 100% sure, but it's a very significant mitzvah. So then the question becomes, how do we understand what is the nature of this mitzvah? This is an important debate, which we don't have time to look at in depth, but if you look on page 2, you have a tshuva from Rav Moshe Feinstein, and on page 3, you have a piece from the Minchas Chinuch. They ask the question, it's going to be relevant for us as we move a little bit further, what exactly is the mitzvah of Pru Ravu? Because we mentioned before, let's say, Lo Aleinu, a person, their children, God forbid, predeceased them, so they have not fulfilled the mitzvah of Pru Ravu. So it's a very difficult, so then, how do I fulfill that mitzvah? Let's say a person has 17 children, but they have all girls. So then, strictly speaking, we said, according to the Gemara, they were not in fulfillment of the mitzvah of Pru Ravu. So what is the mitzvah? How do I define what is the mitzvah? So Rav Moshe Feinstein bases himself on a diuk in a Tosfos, where Tosfos says, look, you know what the maisa mitzvah, the action of the mitzvah of Pru Ravu is? That is the intimate physical relationship between a husband and a wife. That's what it is. That act of intimacy, that constitutes the mitzvah, the actual mitzvah, the technical act of Pru Ravu. That's one approach. So if that's the case, only that which can be defined as this act, intercourse, that is the mitzvah of Pru Ravu. Everything else is just a result of that. But that is, strictly speaking, the Maisa HaMitzvah. Well, to use some kind of other means to bring a child into the world, maybe that's not the mitzvah of Pru Ravu. Maybe it's a nice thing, but maybe it's not, strictly speaking, the formal technical mitzvah of Pru Ravu. Whereas the Minchas Chinuch of Yosef Babad, he takes a totally different approach. He says, actually, the mitzvah cannot be defined as one maisa. It's a totza-oriented mitzvah. It is a result-oriented mitzvah. You're right. The mitzvah is not any specific action. The mitzvah is to have children. And you do the best that you can, because ultimately it's up to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Like the Gemara says in the beginning of Tanis, that the keys of life and death are given to the Almighty. He decides whether we're blessed with children and how many children and how they go. But this will become important as we move further and we think about, wait a second, well, how do we define what constitutes Pru Ravu? What if you bring a child into the world and there was no intercourse? So you'll think to yourself, well, that's a very unusual circumstance, at least in the Jewish tradition. We don't have a tradition of such a thing. So there was a discussion, and this is what you'll see on page 4, and we'll come back to this a little more in depth later. There was a discussion among rabbinic authorities in the following case. You'll see on the left-hand side, we're going to focus on where it's the little number 1. This is the Chelkas Mechokek, which is the earlier commentary on the Shulchan Aruch in Evin HaEzer. He says, Yesh Lehistapek, where I put the 1 on the side with the underline. He says, I'm not sure in the following case. Turn over to page 5. Isha, top right hand. Isha, Shenisabra Ba'ambati. A woman who conceived through what's known as bathhouse insemination. She immersed herself in a public bath, and apparently there was some sperm that was in that bath, and somehow, according to what the knowledge of the day, this woman became impregnated through the sperm that was in the water in the bathhouse. So what's the shaila? Im kiyam, top line on page 5, im kiyam ha'av pru urvu, if the father fulfilled the mitzvah of Pru Uvu, and is this child considered the descendant of that father, meaning the sperm, in this case, the sperm donor? Maybe he was unwittingly the sperm donor. And there is a tremendous amount of literature about this going on right now, just in the last couple of years. Every few weeks you open up the newspaper, you'll find new cases. There was discussions in the last year. In our Sunday morning shiur, we discussed a little bit a case where someone had donated sperm to a sperm bank, and then all of a sudden he gets a letter in the mail that he's liable for child support for like five children. And he's like, what are you talking about? And so this is a question. Then there's a whole question about posthumous paternity that appeared before the U.S. Supreme Court last year regarding Social Security benefits on a case in Florida. So this is also a further halachic discussion, which we're not going to talk about. But here, this question may have some relevance to the machlokas between Rav Moshe and the Minchas Chinuch about the nature of the mitzvah of Pru Uvu. Is it action-oriented? Well, if it's action-oriented, maybe he didn't fulfill the mitzvah of Pru Uvu if he didn't do an action. Or maybe you say, yes, that's an action by the fact that he deposited the sperm there. On the other hand, if you say that it's totsa-oriented, result-oriented, if you view the father as being the father genetically, that would carry over halachically, then perhaps you would be Mekayim Pru Uvu. There is another aspect of Pru Uvu that's important to keep in mind, and this is summarized by a very, very a lengthy, but very, it doesn't need my approbation, Rav Yaakov Ariel's essay in a medical journal called Asya several years ago. And it begins with a Gemara in Shabbos, at least we're going to begin with the Gemara in Shabbos, on page 6. The Gemara says that when we come before the heavenly court at the end of our time, b'shah shemachnisin adam ladin, when a person is brought in to be judged, omrim lo, they say to him several questions. Number one, I'm on the bottom of page 6, and the underline, did you transact honestly in business? Did you set time for Torah? And then in the underline, osakta bepiria verivya. Did you engage, did you do business, transact in the mitzvah of Peru Urvu, of being fruitful and multiplying? So the fact that this question is asked for us when we have to pay our final roll call, that's not so surprising to me, because we said at the beginning that Peru Urvu is a mitzvah rabbah. It's a very important mitzvah to have children, to facilitate children. That I got. But why does the Gemara say, Asakta bepiria verivya? Did you get involved in Peru Urvu? Why does it say, Kiyamta, you fulfilled the mitzvah of Pru Uvu? It doesn't say that. Why not? Similarly, we started with the Gemara in Yevamos where the Mishnah said, Lo yevatel adam mipiria verivya. A person should not stop pursuing Pru Uvu unless they have one son and one daughter. But what does that mean? Why didn't the Mishnah say a person is obligated to have one son and one daughter? It's a very peculiar formulation. If you look on the next page in the Rambam tells you another couple of peculiarities about this halacha mitzvah Pru Uvu. So in Perek Tesvav Halacha Beis, the Rambam says, "Umeimosai, and from when ha'ish nischayev b'mitzvah zu? When is a man obligated in the mitzvah Pru Uvu? When would you say? How old? I don't know. When am I obligated to put on tefillin? When am I obligated to Sheikh Alulov, not talking about the mitzvah of chinuch, of education. Strictly speaking, when am I obligated in all mitzvahs? By mitzvah, no. And that's not what the Rambam says. The Rambam says, mi ben shvayesrei, when a man becomes 17. And then the Rambam says, well, what if he became 20? And the Mishnah Gemara says, and Kiddushin discusses different ages at which a person may or may not have gotten married. But I don't understand. Why didn't the Rambam say a person is obligated to get married to have children when they're 13, just like every other mitzvah? Well, we know intuitively there's something that doesn't fit with that. Just because a boy is 13 years old doesn't mean that it's suited for him to get married. So the Gemara explains, and there's a commentary from Yosef Shalton Nottinson, called the Yad Shol on the Mishnayos in Perkei Avos, where the Mishnah says Ben Shmona Esrei Le Chuppah. So that's the source for the Rambam, 18 years old for the Chuppah. So the Rambam understands that means when he's 17, the 18th year when he's 17. So he says, well, what about learning? So he had to spend some time learning. What about finding a parnassus? So wait a second, we don't say that if I'm at work I don't have to come home and observe Sukkos. So what is it? There's something about the mitzvah of Pru Uvu that's got to be different. Similarly, the next line in the Rambam, v'imhaya osig b'torah v'tarad ba, and then the next line, mutar le'is acher. If a person is engrossed, they're in yeshiva, they're delving into their learning, and they're so focused, They can't be distracted by dating and getting married and pursuing creating a family. So the Rambam says, okay, it's okay to delay. I don't understand. If it comes time to daven Shacharis, I can't say I'm learning the daf. I don't daven Shacharis. I don't say Kriya Shema. Of course I have to do that immediately. So Rav Ariel points to one more Rambam, which is not actually in Hilchos Nashim, in Ishus. It's actually in Hilchos Deos. Now this is an important question, whether this is descriptive or prescriptive, this Rambam. But the Rambam says, Derech Balei Deya, it's a good idea, Sheyikva lo la'adam, on page 8, Melacha ha'befarneses oso tchila. First find a job. Va'achar kach yikne beis dira. Then find a house. Va'achar kach yisa isha. Then get married. Make sure you have everything lined up. So now whether or not how this is going to apply in today's day and age in the year 2014, I'm not getting involved in that at all. You have to question whether this is descriptive or prescriptive. But the idea that there is a Seder, an order, the Rambam doesn't say first you have to have children because it's a mitzvah of Peruvu. So Rav Yaakov Ariel points out, and Rav Shechter has a similar, Shalit, Rav Shechter has a similar formulation, the mitzvah of Peruvu is not a mitzvah overis. It is not an immediate obligation, which if you don't do it now, it's over. It's a mitzvah to midas. It's an ongoing mitzvah over the person's entire life. Someone could get married at any age and fulfill the mitzvah of Peruvu. So it's not a once and done. And because of that, there are these kind of peculiarities. Number one, it's not in your control whether or not you're Mekayim the Peruvu at the end of the day. It's up to the Ribono Shel Olam. Number two, if there's some reason that you're studying Torah right now, it's not like if you didn't daven Shacharis now, it's too late, you're done. No, you didn't daven now, so you could daven in 5 minutes, so daven in 5 minutes. But at a certain point, you're pushing it off too far. So similarly, when the Sof Zman Tefila, according to the Rambam, at a certain point, you're allowed to push it off. Maybe there's a limit, maybe there isn't. That's a good question. But the idea that asakta, you did your best, you tried. You gave it your all. So that is all that is demanded of you. It's a lifelong obligation to have children to the best extent possible. Whatever you're capable of doing. If a person, lo aleinu, isn't able to find the suitable marriage partner and it doesn't work out for them, so then we have a principle in halacha that's onus rachmana patre. If it's not your fault, if it's an accident, you're not obligated. If a person has 17 girls, it's gavaldic, it's great, beautiful. A lot of neshamas in the guf are finished. They didn't fulfill peruvu. Okay, they're onus. There's nothing they could do. Yeah, Mrs. Poling. Great question. So it's a great question. So the question was, is he obligated to have Puruvu with his second wife? So the answer is, it depends. If he has children from his first wife, so then he's no longer obligated because it's about him having those children. The Gemara even has a machlokas, it's two days in the Gemara, about whether a person was not Jewish, had children, and then converted. Do the old children, with whom he is not technically related anymore because he's like a new person, does that count? So there's discussion, we pass in La Halacha, but the concept is, as long as he has those children, that's it. Doesn't matter how many wives he has. So in this light, we can now get to kind of start to think about transitioning, which is a person obligated to undergo assisted reproductive technologies to have children? Are they strictly speaking obligated? So especially if you take the view that the Maisa of Puruvu is in the matter relation, so then technically the person is not obligated. And this is what Rav Shlomo Zalman writes in the Tshuva. It begins in the bottom of source 9 in Siman Tzadiches. And here he's talking about artificial insemination, which we'll get to in a minute. So it starts at the bottom of page 9, goes over to the top of page 10. Afilu hachi lo ramya klal chiyuva alayu. They're not obligated, on the top of page 10, right-hand column, lehischakim, to do something that's, lehischakim means to be like a dreikup in Yiddish. It would be like to come up with a great shtick, a new idea, a novel concept. This ART, assisted reproductive technology, betachbulos ka'ela. A person is not obligated, even if they don't have any children, to seek these unusual medical interventions. At the same time, and a related tshuva on a similar topic, in the next, we're not going to see the whole thing, on page 11, I gave you the whole tshuva, it's two pages, Rav Asher Weiss Shalita, from Yerushalayim, he has a tshuva, where at the end, he's discussing here, people who lo aleinu have a predisposition to children with some kind of condition that would be some kind of genetic mutation, etc. He says, V'laniyaz daiti, on page 12, af borer, even if it's clear, even if there's no obligation for Puruvu to have children through this unusual medical procedure, yesh b'zeh mishum mitzvah pirei v'rivya. He still says there is a mitzvah of Puruvu, the result is a Puruvu, v'av b'derech zu mekayma oda mitzvah pirei v'rivya kiyum ma'alya, because he brought children and he has the skulos from Chazal, etc. So maybe it's not a strict obligation of Puruvu, but it certainly would be encouraged. It would certainly be a great mitzvah to pursue these medical avenues. Now again, there are always limits to how much a person can spend on a mitzvah. Dr. Brash pointed out, depending on a person's insurance and what country they're in, you know, one round of IVF could cost $10,000 or $15,000 or $18,000. It used to be more, now it's a little bit less, but you could be paying $17,000. So maybe it's out of pocket, maybe it's not, but these are significant expenses you have to figure out. But the idea is, maybe based on the background of Puruvu, you're trying your best. The question is, how much more do you have to do? So maybe you're not obligated. So now let's look on the other side, talking about a little bit about medical advancements and halachic considerations. So let's start with the oldest trick in the book, and that's called intrauterine insemination, where essentially they would take a syringe and inject it directly into the woman. And by doing so, they would avoid various pitfalls, assuming that there was... Let's assume right now it's called AIH, artificial insemination from the husband. So assuming that there was some problem as to why the woman wasn't able to conceive, and the way to rectify this problem would be to directly inseminate the woman into her uterus, and hopefully one of the eggs will catch with one of these sperm, and it'll be Shalom al Yisrael. So the question is, and this is a very old topic already back from the 19th century when they started doing this in the general world. So the question became before many poskim. And at this point, each one of these sub-circles and subtopics could be its own shir, but I just want to kind of spend the next 15, 20 minutes giving a brief overview of these questions. So the first question was going to be whether or not the father is in fulfillment of the mitzvah of Puruvu by using intrauterine insemination, which is where a sperm is procured from the husband, which we'll talk about that in a second. It's going to be injected into the wife, but there was no physical interaction between the two. Well, what does that sound like? It sounds like that strange case that we saw in the Chalkas Mechokek of bathhouse insemination. So we saw that was a question, whether or not, that was the suffix in the Chalkas Mechokek, whether or not a woman who was inseminated by immersing, by dunking in a bath, does the father, the sperm donor, is he mekayim the mitzvah of Puruvu? So many poskim today, I would say the majority of poskim assume, check, yes, the father, in the case of where the husband is the donor, is in fulfillment of the mitzvah of Puruvu. But that was a suffix in the Chalkas Mechokek, and not all authorities agree. The second suffix in the Chalkas Mechokek was about yichus, about the lineage of this child. Assuming that the father is the sperm donor, it's a very good question about whether or not this child, if the father was a Kohen, is the child a Kohen? If the father was a Levi, is the child a Levi? So this is a further question. Again, most poskim assume that he would be, but there is some question about that. Rav Shechter has a discussion about that in one of his essays. The third, and maybe one of the most challenging questions, is how to procure the sperm for the insemination, because we have a principle that appears in the Gemara, Maseches Nida, Daf Yud Gimel Amud Beis, which is called Hashchasa Zera, destroying and wasting seed. So the Gemara says that's a very serious concern. Now, there is a minority opinion in the Acharonim, the Shilas and Shuvas Bnei Yoshua, who discusses that maybe it's only rabbinic in nature, and the pasuk that the Gemara brings is an asmachta. It's just kind of a hook. But the Gemara has very, very strong language about the Isra of Hashchasa Zera, wasting seed, and that's what Er va'Onan, these two biblical figures, that's why it's called Onanism, wasting seed. So this is a good question. How are you going to procure sperm for the procedure of intrauterine insemination? So it's a great question. So the Gemara has a discussion about what's called grumma, indirect causation. So that's potentially one avenue. So initially there was something called PCT, postcoital test, where they would collect the zera after the husband and the wife had been together, but that causes all kinds of complications, whether they had to be together in the doctor's office. And there are a lot of different questions, and again, this could be a whole shiur in and of itself, but it's just something to think about, the question of how to procure the sperm from the husband for the purpose of insemination. And if the husband does have to provide a sperm sample, does that moment, and this would be the view of some poskim, bam, that's called hashchasa zera, wasting seed, because it's not into any particular person, it's into a petri dish. So the other viewpoint, which is accepted by Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and many other poskim, is that no, since it's for the purpose of peruvu, you need to put it in a dish now so that you can use it later, so then that would not be considered hashchasa zera. But it's an interesting question to think about, and this is why, if you speak to Dr. Brash, he'll tell you that different people have different procedures of how they go about doing this. Now, do they have to, generally, when they do this, they'll do something called a sperm wash. Well, they'll pick the best sperm. Well, what happens to the rest of it? Well, do they use that, or is that called hashchasa zera also? So this is something further to think about. And then the last question, which is dealt with in that shuvah for Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, so one of the brachas that we saw in a second, which is, what if the wife is a nida? There used to be this thing, although today, thank God, it's much more treatable, called orthodox infertility, which was that if a woman, her ovulation took place before she could get home from the mikvah, so now the couple is not going to be together until it's going to be past the time when she'd be able to conceive because the ovulation was too early. So how do you deal with that? So this was a discussion if you look in Machon Pua online, they have like a whole battery of options of how couples can deal with orthodox, what used to be called orthodox infertility, because it was orthodox practice that kept them from being together before the woman was ovulating. But let's assume that that's not going to be possible. You can't get her back from the mikveh any earlier, and this is what it is. So potentially one avenue might be, if you collect the sperm sample, maybe what you can do is inseminate the woman while she's still in nida before she got back from the mikveh. Is that okay? Well, on the one hand, the husband's not near her. There's no physical interaction between the two of them. On the other hand, she's conceiving, she's potentially conceiving while she's still in the status of a nida. So this is further debate among the rabbis. Again, this each one of these could be a shir in and of itself, but it's just to sensitize us to some of the issues that are involved. So in that tshuva, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach says it is permitted. Why? Because the iser of nida is for the husband and the wife to be together while the woman is in the status of nida. But if he's not anywhere near her, so then you can't say that it's a problem of hiskarvos b'yemei nidasa. So Rav Shlomo Zalman in that tshuva says it's permitted to do artificial insemination, IUI, while the woman is Anita. So before we move on, any questions, comments, or observation on this piece? Yes?
The first case that you gave, the IUI,
yes.
You said there's no difference between that and the woman goes into the bed. But there is a difference.
Okay, good.
The difference is one's the husband.
Oh, okay, very good. So George is pointing out, you're already, all right. Ta-da! Very good. So that is going to be the perfect segue to the next question, which is AID, artificial insemination from a donor. So that would be a big difference. Right? The other difference, some would say, is there's another significant difference. In the case of the bathhouse insemination, that guy had no intention, no kavana, to be mekayem the mitzvah of puruvu. He had no intention of even impregnating anyone. Right, but I'm saying let's assume it was the husband in the first case. But maybe you could say, wait a second, in that case of bathhouse insemination, there was no kavana, there was no intent, that wasn't called a maisa mitzvah, that was some guy, whatever. As opposed to in this case, the person has kavana, they have an intent. So can that also play a role? Can you say that this constitutes a maisa that of puruvu because the person had some consciousness of what they were doing? So that would be another distinction to say, and this is what is dealt with at length in the postgame. Do you say that the case of bathhouse insemination of Iber Bambati is a good model? Let's assume even if it was the father in the case of the bathhouse insemination, where there is some strange old called Oxford manuscript of the Sefer Ben Sira, that Ben Sira was the son of Yirmiyahu, and that's part of the question. Maybe it was the father, but even if it's the father in that case and the father in its case, who says that the cases are analogous? We were assuming that they were analogous, but maybe not. That case, there was no intent. Here, there is an intent. Here, someone actually directly has to insert it into the woman. Yeah, Doc, what were we going to say?
Is there a mitzvah on the woman for puruvu?
Oh. So technically speaking, the Gemara says that it's only a mitzvah on the man, not a mitzvah on the woman. So it could be the woman has a component of the mitzvah. There's discussion also about getting married. Maybe the woman also has a component of the mitzvah because, generally speaking, you can't get married by yourself. So there's going to be an important involvement, but strictly speaking, only the father's mitzvah is obligated approval. Yes?
You used the word Adam, when Adam is used in the Gemara. Is that a person or is that man specifically?
In what context? It's a great question.
Here, because when a Adam comes from the din, and they ask him, did you osek kapur abu? So if this means one, then that would include women.
Great.
If it was supposed to be just man, why doesn't it say each?
Right. It's a good question. I think we could look at that question specifically from a parshanut or a drash standpoint, why the Gemara uses those formulations. So I think it's a great question. Technically speaking, it's only the man who is obligated in Puruvu. There's a great question, Tosis raises this question, about whether women are obligated in Sheves. Maybe this is what you're alluding to, Doc. You're right, Puruvu, that the Gemara says, strictly speaking, only applies to a man. But maybe Sheves, so Tosis sounds like he has two deos, two different opinions as to whether or not Sheves was the secondary level, the fact that we settled the world. So the woman is populating the world. So Tosfos has two questions, two deos, two opinions as to whether or not a woman is obligated in Sheves. But that doesn't sound like it's the question in the Gemara that you're referring to. That Gemara referring to specifically a man. Okay, so now let's move to this next question, which is perhaps more common and quite complex, which is IUI. We're still with intrauterine insemination, but it's artificially inseminated by a donor. So now you have a lot of questions because this donor is some other random person. And let's assume that it's a Jewish person for the moment. So now you have a husband and a wife and an interloper, some other man who's providing the sperm. So the big question became whether or not this child is a mamzer. So that's not so clear. So many rabbinic authorities were of the opinion that donor sperm, which is being inseminated in a married woman, if the donor was Jewish, the child is a mamzer. Because it's a mixture of a foreign husband's sperm and a married woman. Rav Schechter points out, we don't have time for this, talking about two deus and a gerus and a rashba, potentially two deus and a tosis. Also, this is a big debate. Rav Moshe Feinstein was of the opinion that that's not the case. That since there was no interaction physically between this man and the married woman, the child does not become a mamzer. The only creation of the mamzer was because of the act of intimacy that was prohibited. But in this case, there was no act of intimacy that was prohibited. And therefore, you can't say that the child is a mamzer. But this became a great brouhaha about 30, 40, 50 years ago in rabbinic literature about whether or not the child is a mamzer. That's question number one. But question number two is, okay, so let's say the child is not a mamzer. So who is the father of the child? Let's assume, generally speaking, the child's father is determined at the time of conception. So the child's father is some Jewish person from a sperm bank somewhere. Well, how many sperm did this particular donor donate? A few million, probably. So now, this woman A, has this man's child somewhere. And then woman B goes to a sperm bank, collects unwittingly the sperm from the same donor. She also has a child. And the children grow up very fine. They both go off to some particular location. They meet somewhere, and now they're interested in finding a shidduch together, creating a shidduch. So now we have a problem, because unwittingly, this daughter and this son are brother and sister. So there is a rabbinic journal, I think it was called Hamaor, where they documented a case that this happened. So that's why, even if you're going to tell me that the donor is Jewish, and therefore the child has a yichus to a father, potentially, but now you have a big shidduch problem, because who's going to keep track? Who's going to keep track that this child is from a sperm bank of such and such a man, so that when, if it's a boy, when he goes out to marry, he shouldn't marry the girl who is the daughter of a woman who received, and generally speaking, at least when I was dating not that long ago, that wasn't one of the questions that was being discussed. It's not like you sit down at a date and you're like, so, was your mother artificially inseminated by a sperm donor? You know, that wouldn't go over very well. So this is a very... this is a very, very tricky question. Whether or not, if a woman is going to pursue a sperm donor, for that donor to be Jewish, it's very complicated. So there are some discussions in Israel of ways to track the parent of this child, but it's very complicated. So if you speak to a posek, a prominent posek, they will discuss whether or not it's better to have a Jew or a non-Jew. In many cases, they would say better not to have a Jew. Have a non-Jew, and therefore the father has no connection to any other people in the world. Yeah.
Nowadays, where you can check for the DNA, can't you just get the DNA profile? They'll tell you.
So potentially, that's a good question. One question has to do with the application of using DNA for identification purposes. And generally speaking, we assume that DNA is it's like a simen muvuk, according to Rav Zalman Chemia and many other great poskim. So that would be very good. But then you get into a little bit dicey. This is beyond genetic testing now. You're talking, I want the DNA of your father, or you. I don't know, how would you do that? How would you could do it. All right, Dr. Shab says you could do it, but Lamaisa, it's not so easy.
Seems equally uncomfortable on the dating.
Yeah, I would say also not so good on the dating situation. So then many poskim would say, you know what, you're better off getting non-Jewish sperm to be donated. Well, then the problem, if it's non-Jewish sperm, is then there is a spiritual component that we would say some posts can discuss of Zera Yisrael, that this it's preferable that it should come from a Jewish parent. Not that there's anything wrong with you have a child that's born from a father who's not Jewish, the child is 100% Jewish. And so too, if you have somebody who's not Jewish who converts to Judaism, so they become fully part of it. We're not racist. We can take anybody from anywhere. But this is another consideration. So these are some of the questions when you talk about donor sperm. It's not just the original questions of artificial insemination. It gets even more complicated when you talk about donor sperm. Yeah?
How does that solve the problem of non-Jewish sperm? If you're still a brother, marrying a sister, the same non-Jewish person.
Ah, but you'll know the mother. That's the difference, right? We know who this kid's mother is. We know his mother is, because the mother can't, right? I'm not talking today about surrogacy at all, because that would be a whole nother discussion. But the problem here is that, you're right, they're going to be, let's say you and I are brothers, but we have to look at both our father and our mother. So the mother, we know who it is. We know who the kid grew up with. We know who raised this child. We know who she is. We have it on the records from the hospital, right? The hospital records, they say, doesn't it say, the mother was such and such. So that's who it is. You can't deny that. It's easy to check that. The problem is if the father's out of the equation, now he's the sperm donor, he's in the pocket somewhere, no one knows who he is. So that's the variable where it becomes a problem. If the sperm donor is Jewish, we don't know where that sperm came from elsewhere. And who else might be from that father? Who else might be related? Okay, I'm going to cut it here. Just... Exactly. If the father is not Jewish, there is no halachic relationship between the child and the father. The father could have 500 other children. None of them are related from a Jewish standpoint. From a non-Jewish standpoint, they are related.
They could still be brothers and genetics.
Yes, exactly. They could be, but if two people convert independently, they're technically, from a strict Torah standpoint, a brother and a sister could marry each other. Okay, now you add another level of complication, which is IVF. IVF is not in vivo. It's not in the body. It's where a woman becomes inseminated after the sperm and the egg are put together in a petri dish. So as part of this course that I was blessed to participate in with the Rabbi Reichman, Dr. Reichman, so we actually visited two different IVF labs and we saw how they do these procedures. It was really very, very fascinating. And there was no blood and guts. It was my kind of lab. That was the place. Nothing gory. It looked just like this. So here are your questions. Now you're talking about fertilization in a lab. So you have all the questions that you began with in terms of IUI, but then you have an additional question. And that is that this sefer, which is, if you're talking about medical halacha, you can't talk without mentioning the sefer, Dr. Abraham S. Abraham, he compiled this sefer called Nishmas Avraham. The first version was reviewed with great scrutiny by the Gaon Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Dr. Abraham is himself a very accomplished a physician and a noted Torah scholar. So this is the second edition of the Nishmas Avraham. So he quotes some poskim, I believe it's from Leizer Waldenberg, who says, talk about Puruvu, okay. IUI, you could say the father's Mekayim Puruvu. He fulfills Puruvu. Why? Because at least the insemination took place inside the woman. In this case, the insemination takes place in a laboratory. He says, that's not Puruvu. Now, many poskim dispute that matter. Rav Nevensal Shlita Shalomiwel, he's also quoted here. He says, that's not true. Here too, the father can perform the mitzvah Puruvu, but that's a further question. Another question comes up, what do you do with the excess embryos? The plurality poskim say, no problem, they're not inserted into the woman, so you can just discard them. But it's an interesting to think about the fact that you have fertilized embryos, are those considered life? So we generally assume, this was a discussion a couple of years ago, the OU came out with a statement when they discussed embryonic research that it's okay, you can do research because they're not life, they're not within a woman's body. But then you come to the third question, which is, are there added health risks? And this is something that's discussed in the medical literature that when they're doing IVF, so they're going to fertilize several eggs and then they're going to implant them. Well, depending on Dr. Brash will tell you, depending on the particular age of the woman and her level of fertility and what the risks are, they may be implanting multiple fertilized eggs. In some cases, in some freak cases where you have unscrupulous doctors, they want to pump up their statistics and say, come to us, 80% chance you'll get a baby. Yeah, if they implant 5 or 6 embryos, and then you can end up with the quintuplets, which is a humongous health risk both to the babies and to the mother. So here also you have an halakha question about, in terms of IVF and additional health risks. Now within IVF, there's one other concept, and that's called PGD. So PGD is pre-implantation genetic determination. And that is, now they could do another thing where they create these little embryos in the Petri dish, and then let's say you have 6 or 7 fertilized embryo halach in there. That's not a medical term. Just so you look at them, you're going to pull out each one, and now they can actually map, and as far as I know, recently I just heard of research that they're actually doing DNA transplants where they're fixing certain genetic defects in the, it's unbelievable. But let's say now they've mapped all the genomes, so they look in these little embryos and they pick out one, they say, oh, this one has a marker for such and such a problem. Lo aleinu, for all kinds of genetic disorders. So they say, oh, that's not a good one to implant. And then this one, that's a good one, it has no problems. So what do we think about this? This is a further, this can only be done in IVF, because then you need the fertilized embryo that they're going to do a check on each one. Well, some cases, some might say, well, that's, you know, interesting. I'd like a child with blue eyes and blonde hair, very tall, good in basketball, right? No BRCA gene. Who knows what you could find? So this became an interesting discussion. Contemporary Poskim are discussing it in a different scenario. So here you have two letters that are in your packet. There is a Gemara on Daf Yoram and Aleph and Brachos. The Gemara on page 13 tells a story, and we're out of time, we can't talk about it. It tells a story of Chizkiyo HaMelech and Yeshayo HaNavi, where they're having a discussion about why Chizkiyo didn't want to have any children. So Yeshayo says to him, just because you know through divine intervention you're going to have a child who's not worthy, so what? Bahadi kivshi derachmona lamalach. Why are you getting involved in the secrets of God? So this is one argument to say, PGD, now you're starting to inspect the DNA of every human embryo. Maybe that's the Nistaros L'Hashem Elokeinu. Those are the secrets for God. So this is a debate. Rav Menachem Bernstein, the great Talmud Chacham, the founder of Makon Tua, so he sent a letter, which is on page 14, several years ago about PGD to different Rabbanim. And the last page is the letters that I have up here. On the right-hand side, it's from Rav Shlomo Amar, the former chief rabbi of Israel, now currently just elected the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, the Sephardic chief rabbi of Yerushalayim. That's the letter on the bottom, where Rav Amar is not in favor of PGD. He says, he quotes the Ramban about Mipnei Ha'odam Shemisarev B'mai Sebereshis. He says, I'm not so sure that we should be pursuing PGD because you're getting yourself involved in the Mai Sebereshis, in the process of creation. It's a good question. On the other hand, Rav Nevensal, on the top in the handwritten letter here, this response, Rav Nevensal does not say that PGD is not acceptable. So there was this case in Machon Pua where you had the case that we mentioned to begin with, where you had the father who was a Kohen who was going to get a donor sperm, assuming that this donor sperm is not going to be Jewish. So now the child is for sure not going to be a Kohen. So what are they going to do? So in Machon Pua, they published in one of the essays that this was permitted. If you look on the last page, if you look on page 16, this is a Shaila from the Mare Bazak, which is the Chuvas of Eretz Chemda, where they got a fax from Montreal, Canada, from Tavshin Samach Aleph, regarding choosing the min, PGD, for choosing the min of the child. So they discuss here, and they discuss that it's a machlokas aposkim, practically how to pursue this process, but Rav Shlomo Zalman is quoted in here, discusses the fact that PGD can and probably should be used in cases where they have specific genetic malfunctions that you have to be concerned about. But all of this is taken into consideration as a person, as a rabbi, and a couple discuss with their physician the different aspects of fertility and halacha. So to summarize, this is the last essay. It's not in your packet. I just added it since Friday because this Prezi was coming to light in the last week. This is an article by Dr. Reichman. It appeared in 1998.
the halachic chapter of ovarian transplantation. So when he wrote this essay, Dr. Rachman points out, there's no such thing as ovarian transplantation. But now there is. So if you want, you can look up this tradition article that appeared in 1998 about the original sources of what were the rabbis saying in the 1910s and 30s about halachic organ transplantation of a uterus. So the first half of the year, we spoke about the mitzvah of puravu. Then we spoke a little bit in terms of a survey of medical advancements and halachic considerations. And there's a lot more to say, certainly, about surrogacy and other things, but we want to take a two-minute break before we introduce Rabbi Shabtai. Thank you very much. Take a quick break.